Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. It's Monday, the 13th of November. It's 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard, and we begin every Monday with none other than John Bailey, who is the publisher and the editor of White Plains Citizenet Reporter. And you could find him and his website at WPCNR.com. And one of the most compelling articles that he just posted for, I think it was done today, or no, it was actually done a few days ago, is from Dr. Caitlin Gentilina. And she writes in the column, the title of her article is States Are Withholding Vaccine Information. And she says, as a subtitle, and why they should be working in overdrive to do the opposite. And I don't understand why we don't. So what do you think about all this, John? Because I'm flabbergasted that we're not being told the facts.
Well, this is I was shocked when I read that the states would just not tell people about vaccine availabilities and how to get it. I mean, just giving people a choice and then it's up to them is a no-brainer, because the elderly are dying from COVID. They get sicker. And also, we have so little information on school infections across the country. People aren't keeping track of it. And I know in White Plains, we don't keep track of it. We don't have any information regularly from the school district. And in Westchester, they've also stopped reporting it. And we do not know how much that's contributing to our weekly COVID count, which is now running about 79 a day.
Well, that's very interesting, because in Yonkers, we haven't been reporting for months. And I still find it just incongruous that the state and the cities and the county are not giving us the facts, because a lot of people don't realize how many deaths have been caused by COVID. And if people knew maybe there's an aversion to these inoculations. And what was really fascinating to me was in this report that while there's an excess amount of deaths with regard to COVID, and that's been going on from the very beginning, there's a virus called RSV. I took the inoculation, I think, over a month and a half ago. It was offered at Walgreens, and they had it. And I said, oh, well, might as well take this because, you know, I've got all kinds of morbid concerns, you know, high blood pressure, heart disease, and who knows what else, diabetes. So these are not good. And to be honest with you, it's not like we're such a minute population. You know, a lot of people, they're older, they have these problems. So why doesn't the state and the county and the cities, why don't they tell us what's what? And then we can make a decision if we want to avoid it. Well, fine. And if you drop dead, you'll drop dead. That's your problem at that point, because you can make a decision. But why are we denying people the opportunity to make a decision for their own life? That's what I don't get.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's not much vaccinating going on.
No.
Not many pop-ups anymore in the county. And the emphasis is off. In fact, the county executive does not even talk about COVID anymore.
Exactly.
I mean, it's pretending everything is over, and COVID is—it's not over. Basically, the White Plains hospital figures last week they had at the end of Friday, the first 10 days of November, they had 93 admissions to beds. And 49, and about 46 of them had COVID after being admitted to hospital beds. That's 49%.
Yeah, that's mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling to me. But that's a question. Are people coming into the hospital for attention because they think they have COVID, or what are they coming for?
They're coming for scheduled procedures.
Uh-huh, for scheduled procedures, and then they find out that they also have COVID.
Yeah, it's important to know this, and because they're supposed to, you know, be testing themselves before they go in.
Well,
to make sure
I know that when I go to the hospital and I've got an appointment later on in the week, I have to take the COVID test.
Right.
I mean, they didn't advise me, but this was a standard procedure from the past. So I don't see why I shouldn't take the test as well. And I don't want to take it at home because I don't really know if that's good enough. They've been laying around here, and I had like extra tests I could take. They may be out of date. They may not function as well. It's no big deal. I can go in, and there's a place where they do COVID testing only about a block and a half away. So why shouldn't I do it? And
and
you know what's interesting? A lot of people don't realize when you walk into a hospital setting, and I have to go there for other issues, you're going to a place that is the most infectious place you could conceivably go to. Because why do people go there? They don't go there to go to the bathroom. They go there because they got an appointment with a doctor for some reason or another. And many of them could be sick. So I cover up when I go to the hospital. It's not like I take off my mask. It's not safe down there. It isn't, you know?
Right.
And
absolutely.
I don't understand, you know, maybe we don't elucidate all these points to people. Maybe we're not teaching them how to validate what is or is not pertinent to them. And by being obtuse about the issue with regard to this disease that's going on, because people can get infected, if we don't get any information about it, people think it's over. And it's not.
Well, that's exactly what playing it down does. It lulls the public. The public wants good news. They want to know everything's okay. They want to know prices are going down. And when prices aren't going down, they're suspicious. And
I don't know where this is going to go.
Well, the situation really depends on what we do in November and December, because right now we are about half the number of infections we had last year at the end of the month of October. And that would mean if we continue to like socialize like we did last November and December when everybody gets together for the quote holidays unquote, we should reduce the number of infections below 6,000. Last December, we had 12,000. Now, that's only if we don't spread it more. But I think the projections basically are pretty reliable. If you cut things in half, you're going to cut things in half a month later, you know?
Except I feel that with people not aware of the numbers on on a local level or on the county level or on the state level. And they really should also know what else is going on in other states as well. I think that causes a lack of concern about it. And people are going to get together. We've got holidays over the winter. We've got, it's going to get cold. People get close to one another, you know, and they'll be going out as much as before, if not more, because they feel that there's nothing out there.
It's going to
exacerbate the problem.
As usual. And you have to wear a mask when you're out. I'm somewhat negligent, when I go out, because, you know, you start thinking, hey, it's okay, but I'm just like everybody else. The mask is ridiculous because it costs, but it does protect you. It does protect
Well, that was the thing that, that was the thing that I found really unnerving. I thought that the mask would protect one, but then they said the mask doesn't do anything. All of a sudden, that came out about a month or a month and a half ago. I think that, that's, I'm very bad with dates and times, time frames. So maybe a month, even 2 months ago, they made it seem that it doesn't really matter. And
well,
and I saw less people walking around with a mask.
Yeah, the CDC has done a terrible job. They keep changing their message depending on who says what. And this gives people a mixed message. And if you give them the choice of doing the least restrictive behavior, they think it's okay. That you can't do that. You can't. You it's like making rights on red.
It's a very valid point, John. You always seem to be able to pierce through the BS and get to the point, which I think is
wonderful. In White Plains, Hezzy, the jaywalking problem, crossing in the middle of a block, is a real epidemic, and it is very dangerous for drivers because all of a sudden people will be walking across the street looking at their cell phones in the middle of a block, and you have to avoid hitting them.
Wow.
This happens frequently in White Plains. And also, you know, pedestrians crossing in crosswalks legally are at risk for people making rights on red.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's a very bad rule, these crosswalks.
It is. I want to talk to you about other things with respect to White Plains and general area. There is talk that George Lattimer might be eyeing a run for a congressional seat, and same thing with Bowdoin. So what's going on there?
Well, I think it is once again a very seamy side of politics. Is that when Jamal Bowman defeated Elliot Engel in a district Engel had held for like 30 years, and this, and he was chairman of a very important Senate congressional House committee. This infuriated the Democratic Party, and they were out to get him. So they gerrymandered his district, taking away his primary Latino and black constituency, and set it up so he would be more at risk for being displaced in this election.
Yeah.
And now they're running the big gun, George Lattimer. He hasn't decided yet, but he was interviewed by my friend Peter Katz over the Westchester Business Journal last week, and he said he was delaying the decision until December. What is going on here?
Yeah, that's very interesting why he would delay it till that
time. If you're going to run, you have to jump in and absolutely steamroller him now. You never know when the ceasefire is going to happen over there in Palestine. And you lose an issue because that's why he's running. The Jewish rabbis, well, of course, they're Jewish. They came out really against Bowman for his humanitarian stance on the ceasefire, which I thought was fascinating to me that men of the cloth would advocate vengeance. That's what it's doing, advocating vengeance. I was just stunned by that.
It's hard to contemplate. I think a lot of people are playing politics, and it's very hard to contemplate what is appropriate and what isn't.
It's all politics, the dirtiest business.
It really is dirty. And, well, that was the thing that was interesting as well with Engel. I don't remember exactly what he said, but he thought that he wasn't on a live mic, but he said something derogatory about the crowd that he was speaking to. And I think they were on Fordham Road in the Bronx or in that area. And so I don't remember what he said, but evidently he could not live that down.
I remember vividly what he said. He said, the only reason I'm here is because I'm being primaried.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And that was absolutely a Romney moment. Romney defeats Obama in the presidential election if he never made that statement about to the effect that the poor don't count in a meeting and was recorded doing it. And that was that was the end. He lost a lot of minority voters and poor politicians are full of themselves, and they often commit hubris, and it hurts them.
Well, it is fascinating. I think that's a very valid point that you're making. But the problem is that these politicians are the ones that are causing derision and divide, and rather than bringing us together on issues that concern everyone. And if you can't do everyone with one swoop, then you have to do it so that you could show that you still recognize the differences in society, and you can ameliorate all of them by making sure that whatever you contemplate from a legal perspective in politics, that it serves the greater proportion of people. And I don't know why we don't do that. There used to be a time when that seemed to somehow fit in. And now it's just derision and divide. It just doesn't seem to work anymore. I don't know if the people that are in politics have just lost their direction.
They've become very segregated in their feelings as to who is important. And I have a new slogan going forth. All lives matter.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't know why we forgot that. And why did we get away from all and become so finite in our thinking, and it became only this group or that group? What happened? I don't understand why we moved from a place where
we started demographic politics.
There was a time when we said all, there were a lot of people that were excluded from all. So I guess maybe that's how we moved from all to defining one group over another, or and another, but not necessarily over another, but and another, and we still lost the ability to serve everyone, and we still have that. But that's part of the bias and bigotry of our society. I don't know what's going to bring us together.
Well, that's a good question. It's certainly not going to be the next election. My feeling is that Trump, if he gets the nomination, will definitely win. I mean,
he's running ahead of everyone.
Biden has no traction at the present time with the vast electorate. However, people have to wake up and smell the coffee. My feeling is that after Trump's reporting on Trump's policy, once he gets in, he is just going to really crack down and throw a lot of immigrants and migrants who are in this country illegally out of the country. And he's going to establish huge concentration camps of them. I mean, it was just appalling reading this. And if he does that, that's just the start. because
what do you think about Nikki Haley's performance,
etc.?
What do you think of Nikki Haley's performance? Because I thought that she really won the debate on the Republican side of the ticket, and I was really quite surprised. I mean, I don't have any aversion to voting for a woman to a particular office or any office for that matter, but I was just overwhelmed by how well she did. I thought she did well before, but this last debate, she just excelled beyond everyone else. And Ramaswamy, the audacity of him bringing up her daughter, that was insanity. And I'm glad she called him scum. Which is appropriate.
Yes. Well, the problem here is, who is Trump's running mate going to be? My friend Peter and I were discussing this, and we feel that Trump would definitely have a woman vice president, so to appeal and hold the Republican-oriented women who may be put off by the abortion thing, but who definitely will perhaps vote for somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene, or who knows, a Nikki Haley. Although I don't think Trump will pick Haley.
Why not? Why do you think not?
She's very mainstream, I think. Well, I don't know, but Trump has never really been a woman's champion. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's. That's very generous of you, to be honest with you, considering his behavior, his past behavior speaks for himself.
Well, look, Trump is going to be a disaster as a president again, because he's going to be getting even with all the people that have been after him for the last 4 years. He's going to be after journalists. He is going to be after radio and television stations. He's going to perhaps do the insurrection law again. I mean, the article that was written by the New York Times about what Trump is going to do in his next term is extremely frightening. It's very similar to what Hitler did after he got in as the chancellor in 1933.
What's fascinating is that Trump, I think the thing that turns me off about Trump, not all his policies are off the wall. However, they're eclipsed by his attitude, his capacity to cut and slice people up, his demeanor, the words that he uses to undermine people. It's just outrageous. You know, it's like, you know, he's got a mouth on him that's filthy. Yeah, he is a bully. That's the best term.
And
that's
an intimidator. The kind of guy who would push people around on a playground.
Yeah. So why do people gravitate to him? That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, you know,
there's
an inner evil in every person that wants power over another.
Hmm.
And they lose control of it at times. I have. There are several incidents in my life where I think of every day as I really shouldn't have done that, because I'm not that kind of person. But isn't that interesting? That's what every politician says when he gets caught with his hands in the cookie jar.
That's
not my kind of person. Then why did you do it? Their follow-up question is, well, why did you do it then?
Yeah.
But they never answer.
They never answer that question. Well, John, maybe I've been asking too many questions of you, and you've been so brilliant, as you always are, in responding to them in a lucid and competent way. So what else is important that you recognize is going to be happening this week or happened last week and may influence this coming week?
Well, we had elections in White Plains, and the three Democratic candidates won were all white, but this means that there is no minority representation on the seven-member Common Council in Illinois Plains. That includes the mayor. And
my feeling is this.
This is a disgrace because you have 30% Latino in the city and you have 13% black. So that means 46% of the people are minorities. So you have to have some representation there. And they didn't do that when they nominated
That's the question. Is it conceivable that someone who is not of a particular group, they're not black, they're not Hispanic, can they be represented by people who are white? Or is that just no longer the empathy and the demeanor and the understanding may not be there? And I think it's hard for people who don't come from a particular culture or upbringing to see what it's like on the other side. And there are differences between us. So why don't we recognize that? And why didn't the voters come out? What's wrong with the voting?
Well, that's a big question. I said on my program, West Plains Week, that we have to register more minorities in the city of White Plains. So they will vote. They make a concentrated effort to do that. I mean, the Latino candidate for Common Council got over 1,000 votes, but he was way short of the winners, which all got 6,000.
That's frightening. That really is frightening.
I mean, that's a real strange vote. That means very few Latinos voted or didn't vote for the Latino,
isn't it up to the community? If you're from a Latino community, isn't there a grassroots effort, or should there not be, in order to get people to vote, to at least get them registered to vote? So what's happening? Why aren't they doing it? It sounds like everyone is ignorant.
There are no Latino leaders on the Latino side. I think they're very reticent, and they don't want to be seen. I don't know. It's a question you would have to ask of
people of the Latino community.
I think young Latinos and residents of this city have to, as I say, wake up and smell the coffee and start coming out to Common Council meetings and saying what they think about various issues that affect the Latino and the black communities. You know, that we are now encroaching on Ferris Avenue neighborhood in White Plains with upscale developments, and that black persons cannot afford in that neighborhood.
Do you think there's a reluctance to get involved because somehow certain communities don't believe that they will be able to get anywhere by casting their vote? Do they feel it's not a system that works to their benefit? It may not have in the past, but population-wise, things have changed. Yeah. Shouldn't our black community be more aware of the system? Or Hispanics?
Have to work together. I agree with you. I think the blacks and the Hispanics have to work together.
Most definitely. Well,
and
we're going to have to
wait and see
for that to happen, John.
There's a lot of things we have to wait and see and cross our fingers about. Let's put it that way.
Let's hope it'll be in our lifetime. It'll be very interesting to see how that works. Unfortunately, I think we're going to have to go. So we're going to end up speaking to Michael Edelman right after you. And any last words from you that we should know about or contemplate?
Well, I just think that we are gradually controlling COVID better this fall, and the more we get vaccinated with the shots that we need, the better. And also, take care of yourselves, because there's a lot of other diseases out there other than COVID, which are running wild. RSV, for
RSV,
example.
I mean, I got the inoculation, I think it was about 2 months ago. I was thrilled. I went to Walgreens. They said they had it. And I said, oh, well, why not? It seemed appropriate for me. Anyway, I'll let you go, John. As always, a pleasure.
Okay.
My best
thank you very much for
Brenda.
Having me.
And
as
thank
they
you.
Say on the network.
Bye. Say hello to Brenda Starr as well. Goodbye. Thank you.
Yes. Bye for now.
Right. Be well. Bye. Well, there we have it. None other than John Bailey. He's the publisher, the editor of White Plains Citizenet Reporter. And you could find his website at WPCNR.com. So WPCNR.com. And you could read the very lucid and very important issues and concerns that are brought up by Mr. Bailey on the White Plains Citizenet Reporter.com website. So hopefully you'll think about that. And we'll wait for a moment, and hopefully we'll be getting a call from Michael Edelman, and we'll see what goes on there. And I wanted to talk to him, if it's at all possible, with the Republican, you know, they had the presidential candidates that were there. Oh, here it looks like this is probably him calling. Bear with me a moment. Let's see if we can pull it in.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Mr. Edelman?
Good morning,
what a pleasure.
Eddie, how are you doing?
Thank God. Okay. I'm glad that I'm speaking to you, because I was looking forward to finding out what your take was on the Republican candidates and, for 2024. I was like literally taken aback by how well Nikki Haley did. And I'm surprised that there's such support for her, because I didn't think that there would be a support for a woman candidate. But I think she's very, very strong. And I love the fact that she put Ramaswamy in his place, her daughter, and she called him scum. It was under the breath. I mean, she didn't turn around and said you scum, but I thought it was pertinent. So what do you think about all these candidates, and then Trump, you know, doing his own thing, and yet he's running ahead of the pack? Oops, okay, bear with me a moment, because I think that somehow another
I didn't hear me?
Put some, yeah,
I'm
I can hear you now.
Yeah, I'm having a problem with the phone dropping calls. We've got a big storm over us, and I think that's what's doing it. But anyway, I heard what you were saying. I watched the debate. We should note that Tim Scott, who was number five on the debate stage, dropped out today, this morning.
Oh, wow.
So there are four left. Nikki Haley pretty much took on Ramaswamy, who
yes.
had no business talking about her daughter's TikTok account. That was out of line, and she responded
yes.
accordingly. It doesn't really make a difference, though, does it? Because Donald Trump's leading by 40 to 50 points. So none of these people are even close to him, all right? And in fact, if there were only one of them left, I doubt very seriously that they could mount a campaign at this point for the nomination. I think they have to let the federal trials and the Georgia trial proceed so that the entire nation can see just exactly what he was doing in terms of attempting to overthrow the election and overthrow the government. And I think once people see the actual facts and they don't get screened through Fox News, they will come to the conclusion that he is unfit to hold office.
Why is there a reluctance somehow to make a report
critical?
Really about him even now, a more critical,
yeah.
that's the right term. What's the reluctance in the media?
The media isn't reluctant. Fox News is reluctant, but that's not media.
Yes.
Those are opinion hosts
opinion.
That are in the
right.
business of electing Republicans. They're not in the business of reporting facts. So the reluctance is, once people are tribal, it's extremely difficult to get them to admit that they were wrong.
Uh-huh.
Now, all of these Trump
supporters... Never really thought of it that way, but that's very lucid. That's a great point.
Yeah. In order, they have to change their opinion totally about Donald Trump's political positions, about whether they like him or don't like him, whether he's honest or dishonest. You're asking these people to say, oh, we were wrong for 5 years. And that's very difficult to do. They have to come to that conclusion themselves, slowly, over time.
Is it conceivable that Donald Trump would actually go for one of the candidates that was running against him, but even a Nikki Haley, in order to consolidate a woman's vote? No.
Oh, you mean put him on the ticket as vice president? No.
Yeah.
Because
no.
No. He will not put anybody on that ticket that's remotely critical of him.
Uh-huh. Okay.
He will put somebody on he'll put somebody like a Carrie Lake from Arizona, or there's another governor from I forget where. He'll put people on that have only said good things about him. That's the way he is.
I see. Yeah. And what about on the Democratic side of the ticket? President Biden doing a strong enough campaign, or is he waning? And who else is out there? What about Newsom from California?
Well, recent New York Times polls shows that Joe Biden is losing in 5 out of the 6 swing states.
Yeah.
So that he's losing Arizona, Georgia. He's losing Michigan. And Pennsylvania, and I think he was 1 point ahead in Wisconsin. But, you know, this was a year and a half ahead of time. The problem with Joe Biden is that he's perceived to be too old, even by his own party.
Mm-hmm. Is that the thing that's holding him back? Because otherwise he seems to be doing very well for the country.
That's right. The people don't pay attention to actually what he's doing. They only look at the price of their groceries. And or they look at the price of gas and inflation,
right,
and they blame it on Joe Biden, even though Joe Biden had very little to do with it.
So that's what I don't understand. You know, when I think about it, there's always a press. There is a press, of course, but then so much of the information that gets divulged in the press really comes from different candidates or different perspectives. The White House has an unbelievable capacity to get the message out. Why aren't they doing a better job in getting the message out? You could say, okay, we take responsibility for this, and President Biden takes responsibility for that, but we can't take responsibility for other things that the federal government had nothing to do with. Why can't we explain that?
I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know either.
I don't know why these people are getting paid a big amount
of money.
I'm available, by the way, to travel the country to get his message out. But he's not going to pay me. And the problem is that he really doesn't have a campaign yet. So it's really only the White House, and he can hold a lot of press conferences. But the problem is, if you watch a Biden press conference, even though he has command of the information, he looks like he's exhausted.
Yeah, he does.
He looks like he's not animated by what he's doing, that he's just exhausted and he'd rather be sleeping than talking.
Hmm. I don't know if that can change. That's probably who he is. I didn't pay attention to him 5 or 10 years ago that much.
Well,
so
he's never been excited. He's never been exciting, and he's always been underestimated. So I wouldn't at this point think that he can't win. Because the choice will come down to whether people want Donald Trump back in the presidency with all that he's promising for his next term, which is revenge, using the DOJ to get revenge against his political enemies. He's made that statement right out front. He's going to replace people in the government that are professionals with a bunch of loyalists who will do exactly what he wants them to do. If people want that, it's going to be the end of a democracy, and that's going to be what's on the ballot. whether we want a democracy or we want an authoritarianism.
Do you think that Biden's son is actually diminishing the capacity of the president in any way?
Well, I think so, because there's a cloud over whether or not Joe Biden himself benefited from what Hunter was doing, which was, of course, we know, trading on his father's name.
Yeah, evidently that's the case. But
that's what all sons do.
Pushback.
Well,
sorry?
The issue is, did Joe Biden get any money from China? That's the issue, right?
Well, I mean, if he got money from China, then that would not be appropriate, I don't think.
That's correct. It wouldn't be. But I don't think he took any money from China. There's no evidence that he did. But Republicans in the House of Representatives.
Why can't that come out? In a major statement, you know, it's like, you know, you have to defend yourself when there's stuff that's incorrect.
He's made that statement. He's made the statement that he had nothing to do with his son's business.
So then why?
Because you've got a media out there. You've got Fox News and OAN and Newsmax spurting out disinformation on a 24/7 basis, so that people that listen to those news outlets are not getting the facts, and they're believing what they hear, which is that Joe Biden received money from China through his son, by Hunter. That's what they're being told.
Well,
and
you've
got the House of Representatives, Republican committees, trying to impeach him, even though they have no evidence.
Yeah, that's a thing that I find mind-boggling. It's just an assertion that without proof, which is mind-boggling to me. Well, this is sort of, I mean, I didn't reflect as much on previous administrations in the White House, but this never happened before. Why is it happening now? It seems like there's this interest. Is it all because of Fox News and their message?
Primarily, it's not just Fox, though. There are radio stations around the country that are Fox News imitators that take the same line. Local radio stations in little towns and small cities that don't get Fox News, that used to get Rush Limbaugh, and they have imitators who are spewing the same nonsense in those radio stations while people are driving to work and coming home, and they hear it all the time, day and night, night and day.
Yeah.
And then when you have the House of Representatives and James Comer's committee attempting to impeach Joe Biden, even though they have no evidence of an impeachable defense, then people get confused and they start talking about, you know, Joe Biden taking money from China. So, but the point is, not look at the polls this far out from an election mean nothing.
Okay. Well, there,
now,
there used
I
to
prefer,
be a time
would
when
I would I personally
you,
prefer that yeah. Gavin Newsom were the candidate? Yes, I would.
Yes.
Yes,
and
I would.
You've always mentioned him.
I would prefer that he was a Democrat.
Yeah, well, there was a time I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh, and after a while I just turned it off because it was just so much was opinion. But evidently, even though he's now long gone and may rest in peace, you know, shouldn't everybody, no matter what they did in the past. But the bottom line is he the founder of this sort of rhetoric? And how is it that he was able to take opinion and make it seem that it was all legit?
Because he was very talented at understanding what his audience wanted to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And he would, just like Tucker Carlson and, you know, others on Fox, Jeanine Pirro and Waters, they do the same thing. And they wing anti-democratic message. And he knew that Rush knew that his audience wanted to hear what he was spewing, and they would turn in and they'd be very loyal listeners. And that's how this all started.
Yeah, and then it sprung up people who would try to replicate the Rush Limbaugh, and it went on and
right.
on and on.
Exactly.
Because it was a very lucrative type of posture.
He only made $40 or $50 million a year. So, you know, how lucrative could it possibly be? Yeah.
Exactly.
Exactly.
So, is there a way to contemplate the future at all based on where we are today? Or are the Republicans disheveled because all the candidates that are running for president in the Republican Party, they don't seem to have a chance in hell at the moment with Trump? And
it looks like a rematch, right? Well, you asked me if Biden is too weak. He beat Trump the first time.
Yes.
And everybody said he couldn't do that.
Win.
Right. So if I was betting, I would bet on Joe Biden again to be underestimated. And when voters have to actually make a decision between reinstalling an autocratic president, somebody who's promised to take revenge by using his own Department of Justice to indict his political enemies, when they understand that, they're not going to vote for Donald Trump.
One thing that I really found really compelling was the fact that so many states refused to allow women to make a decision whether they wanted to have a child when they were raped or some other issues. Has that captivated the women to come out to vote?
Look at the elections. First of all, Kentucky reelected a Democratic governor.
Yes.
Right? Ohio,
I'm surprised.
They enshrined in the Constitution a woman's right to have an abortion, and that's a red state. And all over the nation, you are seeing women come out and defend the right to do what they want with their own bodies between themselves and their doctors. So that is an indication of how potent the Roe versus Wade reversal was, and Donald Trump has taken credit for that, and so he's going to have to run with that albatross around his neck.
It did take a long time. Why did it take so long for women? Were they afraid to be heard, or did they have to convince their husbands,
It didn't take long at all. Roe versus Wade was really just overturned recently, and the reaction you're seeing is by women and men, both Republican, Democrat, and Independent, revolting against having their rights taken away after 52 years of being the law.
Exactly. Absolutely. It seems so outrageous to me to think that a law should deny women the right to do what they want with their body.
That's why they turned out and voted in such high numbers, even in red states. Look at Kansas. They came out and voted to allow abortion, and this is everybody, not just Democratic women. This is right across the spectrum. Republicans are voting. So that was a big mistake. But Trump takes credit for the three Supreme Court justices that he appointed. And what they've done to Roe versus Wade. And that can't be put back in the toothpaste jar.
No, you can't. Is there enough support for Donald Trump to get reelected?
I doubt it. But he's going to be the Republican nominee.
Yeah. I can't imagine that people haven't gotten tired of his bombastic attitude, and
we'll find out if in fact he's a nominee and he runs. Don't forget, there are going to be some other people in this race. It looks like you're going to have Jill Stein from the Green Party. She's the one that actually was responsible for Hillary Clinton losing.
Yeah, I remember that.
You're going to find that's right. You're going to get Bobby Kennedy Jr. is going to be on the independent line as well. We don't know who he's going to pull from because he's into conspiracy theories, so he may pull votes from Trump. And then you have the, forget his name, the political consultant, the black political consultant who's going to run as well. So you're going to have several people running. So we won't know polling in swing states until these people are on the ballot lines in those states and the conventions are over and you know, it's off to the races with who's going to win the race. That's when we'll be able to see what the polling is and not before.
Yeah, wow. Boy, there's a lot to look forward to, I guess. It's still tumultuous, whatever the case is.
It's going to be a very interesting year.
Yeah, it will be. And are people tired of these races, or are they still pretty much enamored and interested of who will eventually become?
Most people are not focusing on this stuff at this point. They're focusing on going to work and feeding their families. They're not focused on who's going to be running in 2024. Just the political junkies
too far away.
Focusing on it. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't know. I think it's never too soon to even contemplate what's going on because it might tell us where we're heading. But we could be wrong as well. But I'm not including you in that factor, but that might be my issue, but so on. What else do you find important with regard to the latest news that's come out there?
Is there anything? The rise of anti-Semitism in the United States.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, but is there any way to preclude that? Or and what I found interesting with regard to the anti-Semitism that's just like blossoming like crazy in the United States and all over the world to some extent is that there's a difference of attitude between those that are older and those that are younger, a big disparity. And I'm the older, so I find that what Israel is doing to defend itself is appropriate. But then I guess younger people who are Jewish as well may not think so. And I don't understand what the age has to do with it, to be honest with you.
What has to do with it?
Age.
First of all, younger people are not as religious as older people. That's number one.
True.
And number two, they're more secular. And number two, when they see Palestinians being killed 10,000 at a time by Israel, they believe it's a disproportionate response, and then they start picking on the old tropes about.
Well, you know what I found? What I found interesting is like Israel said, assuming that it's believable, I think it is. Israel said that if the 240 people that were captured would be released, then this whole issue would stop. And why they don't take Israel up on it is beyond me.
First of all, Israel has already bombed Gaza, particularly the northern part, made it basically a parking lot. And and Hamas uses civilians as shields. So Israel going after Hamas results in the death of the civilians that Hamas was using as shields. And if Hamas didn't use them as shields, they wouldn't be dead. But that argument is not part of the discussion for many people. They simply believe that Israel is picking on the Palestinians.
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting, you know, with Shifa Hospital, it's one of the largest. I think it is the largest hospital in Gaza.
Yeah.
But what's fascinating is they don't have fuel. So the incubators are not working and so on and so forth. But I know Israel offered to take those people that were, you know, in incubators, the young kids, very infants, and move them to another hospital. And, you know, Hamas said no. So a lot of this just feeds into it. And then, you know, what I find really pathetic is that it's known that under Shifa Hospital and so many others is an infrastructure of different corridors under the hospital. And that's where Hamas is operating from.
That's correct. And they do that on purpose.
They do that on purpose. And then, so why isn't that coming out? Or is that just like some unique story and nobody wants to talk about it? And I don't know why.
You know, here's the thing. I don't think people care about that. They care about the numbers of civilians that are being killed by the Israelis daily.
Uh-huh.
They're not interested. They're not interested in any defense of that. They don't. They simply don't care if Hamas is got his headquarters under a hospital or not. Now that's probably not fair, but they're emotionally involved and they just look at the numbers of dead.
Hmm. Well, okay. You know, there's, I don't know how this is going to get resolved at this point. It seems like it's impossible to resolve.
Israel's going to bomb Gaza until there are no tunnels, and they'll pave over it, and that'll be the end of that. It'll be a big parking lot.
Yeah. I don't know if there's another way around it.
Well, when you say another way around it, first of all, part of the backstory is that Benjamin Netanyahu was so busy trying to take down the Israeli judicial system that he forgot that the settlers on the Gaza border were vulnerable and they were attacked. So he needs to go. This guy needs to go. And I think Israel will get rid of him as soon as this Gaza thing is resolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I don't know how much longer, but I guess, you know, he's on the way out, whether he realizes it or not.
Exactly.
I guess everything falls under the prime minister's responsibility, I guess he must have been advised about issues that showed that Israel was vulnerable to a great extent. It seems almost illogical that he wouldn't have responded in advance. So that's why he's being blamed, because he didn't do enough, evidently.
Well,
he should have understood.
He didn't do enough. He wasn't paying attention because he was on.
Right.
He was trying to get himself reelected and take down the Israeli judiciary system. So he was he's a right wing autocrat too.
Yeah. Yes, he is. So I don't even know when the next election would come about.
It's a parliament. Don't they have to call an election when there's no confidence vote in the prime minister?
Right.
Well, when they resolve this business,
it'll probably
this
come
war
back.
Against Hamas, once it's over, they'll turn their sights to finding out who is responsible. And that means Netanyahu was responsible because he was distracting everybody from the number one goal of any government, which is to protect its citizens.
Exactly. Yeah, he hasn't been. And what about Blinken's attitude with respect to Gaza and also the West Bank? And he defined what he thought would be appropriate. Can Hamas be running the area that it is now, as well as the West Bank? It's not
you
a
mean
setup.
The Palestinian Authority.
The Palestinian Authority. It's not going
to hurt. They've said they don't want to run Gaza, so they don't want to run anything. They don't want any part of it.
Yeah. Well, they've never been liked, the people from Gaza. They've been despised by other Arabs for a long time, so this is not new. Well, we'll see where it goes. Unfortunately, we've eclipsed a half an hour, which goes so quickly with you. So it's always a pleasure. Thank you for the time that you make. All the
You're
best.
Welcome.
My regards at home. Thank you.
Thanks. Right. Bye-bye.
Be well. there we have it, none other than national and international political analyst and pundit, which most people cannot say. You've got Michael Edelman, Esquire. And I remember when he was still here in Westchester County, and now he's in Florida. And that's it, just a brilliant mind and very astute. And his capacity in language is just exceptional. All right, let's just look at see what else is going on the world stage. Bear with me a moment. See if we can cover some other things here that you may find of interest. Well, bear one second. Well, this is really, really quite interesting. Bear with me a moment. Tens of thousands of people have joined marches against rising anti-Semitism in France over the weekend. French authorities have registered over 1,000 cases of anti-Semitism in the country since the October 7 attacks on Israel by Hamas militants. So that just seems to be... that seems just to be what's going on. So that's just a reality. Bear with me a moment as we move on. there are all kinds of atrocities that are taking place. So we'll see how they go. Bear with me a moment here. This is interesting. Rockland Democrats won several key races in a supermajority on the county legislature for the first time ever. And so we'll have to see what goes on there. And so it goes. So there's a big struggle between one side and the other with regard to what's going on in the Middle East, with regard to Israel. And also Hamas, Hezbollah, and so on and so forth. This was interesting. The Brazilian security services, together with the Mossad, which is Israel intelligence, Mossad and its partners in the Israeli security community, alongside additional international security agencies, foiled a terrorist attack in Brazil planned by the Hezbollah terrorist organization directed and financed by Iran. Unbelievable. Iran is the impetus behind so much that's going on around the world. It's unbelievable. One second. Seems interesting. Parliaments all over the world, including the Houses of Parliament in the United Kingdom, will watch the video of the atrocities of Black Saturday on October 7th. The world must show the inhumane barbarity of the crimes committed by Hamas terrorists to understand what we are all up to. That's from Danny Danon, who's in the Israeli Parliament. And Bernie Sanders, Senator from Vermont, says the House should pass desperately needed aid for Gaza, work to stop the conflict in the Middle East, and address the pressing needs of the American people. Instead, they voted to censure my friend, he says, Bernie Sanders says, my friend, Rashida Tlaib, the only Palestinian American in Congress. Pathetic and shameful, he said. Seems that Donald Trump's daughter, Ivanka Trump, threw her husband, Jared Kushner, under the bus while testifying under oath at the Trump Organization's 250,000 fraud trial in New York. And this was while she was being questioned by prosecutors from Attorney General Letitia James' office. So, my goodness. the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces, said they found a baby in an oven. The baby was put into the oven alive and burned to death. The baby's body was so badly burned, the baby's gender was not visible. The baby's stomach had visible signs of a heating element applied to it. So who knows what's going on? This is unbelievable. It's literally outrageous what's happening nowadays. Let me just see what else is happening. Yeah, from Montreal, we hear that there's a horrifying Jew hatred out of Concordia University as enraged women, a woman screams kike at a Jewish student, and it goes on and on and on. So this is just happening all over the world to one extent or another. And Hillary Clinton said about 5 days ago that last night, 5 days ago, reproductive freedom was on the ballot in Ohio, Kentucky, and Virginia, and it won everywhere. So that's really cool. And I think that's important as well. Okay. Now, let me just see what else is happening. Bear with me a moment. This is really fascinating. This comes from Australian Jewish Association. It's there were signs that said "Gas the Jews" on the steps of the Sydney Opera House. Activists were upset about hearing what was going on there, and just it is just what it is. It's amazing the hatred that's coming out, and that's it. This is what's happening. Unbelievable. I don't know where this is all going to go. It just doesn't seem like it's going to come to a rational conclusion, or when this battle will end. Well, the IDF is roughly about 700 meters from Shifa, a hospital in the heart of Gaza City. This is most likely, it's uncertain though, where Sinwar and the Hamas leadership resides. They've been cut off from most communications with the rest of Gaza, and we'll just have to see where it goes. So I don't know. It's going to be very, very fascinating to see how much longer this crisis will go on. Well, Qatar is supportive of Hamas. And so Qatar will be forced into a higher gear in an effort to preserve some remnants of Hamas. And there were many wounded, elderly, and infants among the hostages. They've been held by savages under conditions we can scarcely imagine, and how could they have survived? So it's going to be very interesting to see where all this goes. There's going to be a reckoning after all this, one way or the other. Okay. Well, we'll just have to see how all this ends up. It just doesn't seem to be a way out at the moment for this crisis to just get reduced to the point of some sort of amelioration of some sort. Well, this is really very interesting. The IDF soldiers have destroyed 130 tunnel shafts since the beginning of the ground operation. They're digging under it and trying to destroy it. The truth is, considering this is all that's been done, you have to wonder why those 130 tunnel shafts that are being destroyed rather than lit a fire and cause flammable gas and literally ignite it to blow the whole thing up. Enough is enough already. Some Hamas members might be trapped inside the tunnels and they want a ceasefire to escape from being buried alive, and that's really one of the big issues. That's where it's all going to go. We'll see what's happened. Shafts are not the tunnels and could get dug up again, seeing how Hamas tries to shaft the entire world. And that's really what it's boiling down to. And like I said, the reluctance to call a rat a rat. And that's it. You have to wonder as well, why didn't the Gaza government invest in power plants and schools and infrastructure? Instead, they spent money on building terror tunnels. Unbelievable. So we'll have to see where all this goes and see how it plays out. But it's not encouraging, that's to say the least. That really is going to be a problem. Okay. This is really quite fascinating. One second. Evidently, a Tottenham winger by the name of Manor Solomon has been suspended from Instagram after his pro-Israel posts, which is truly amazing. It's amazing how media is taking sides one way or the other. A University of Pennsylvania student was arrested for stealing an Israeli flag, praised glorious Hamas, a terror attack, and so on and so forth. And you really have to ask the question is why she's at Penn State and why is she even in America at this point? Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Goes on. Wow. All right. I guess it is what it is. And we'll just have to wait to see how this plays out. There's no way to judge it one way or the other. So it's very, very frightening to say the least. Okay. I want to move on to some other issues that might be compelling. Bear with me a moment. This was really very interesting. I was speaking to what we spoke to Michael Edelman was about earlier. Trumper, Texas Senator Ted Cruz embarrassed himself on national television as a Fox News host, asked him in front of millions of live viewers if he has any evidence of President Biden's crimes, quote unquote. It all started when Fox News host asked Cruz, do you have any evidence that the Department of Justice is covering up crimes for Joe Biden, end quote. Cruz shamelessly responded, quote, well, unfortunately, it is abundantly clear that the Biden Justice Department is covering for the White House, doing everything to impede the investigation into Hunter Biden and, more significantly, to Joe Biden. Cruz falsely declared, quote, we have the text message that Hunter Biden sent to a Chinese communist official demanding millions of dollars saying, I'm sitting next to my father, end quote. Unfortunately for Cruz, Bartiromo, the host, wasn't impressed by his answer and decided to press Cruz again, asking Cruz, quote, do you have actual evidence that Joe Biden made policy decisions based on events that he was actually paid for, end quote. A visibly flustered Ted Cruz responded nervously, quote, on the China piece, Joe Biden won't answer questions on that, so we don't have any information, end quote. There you have it, folks. Even on the friendly turf of Fox News, Ted Cruz fell just flat on his face and made it clear that he and Republicans have absolutely, quote, no information, also known as evidence, on President Biden, end quote. So and that's the story. It's absolutely amazing what's happening here. Unbelievable. You know, you would think there would be something more lucid and that people like him would be able to respond in a very visible way and be understood for their duplicity and their response to questions they seemingly cannot answer. Unbelievable, literally unbelievable. It just is what it is. It's just part of the reality of life. And I just don't get it, to be honest with you. I don't understand where all this stuff comes from, because it's just not making sense anymore, that people have no clue what they're talking about and they just believe. This is the latest information of what's happening. This is about 2 hours old. In the West Bank, Israeli violence increases against Palestinians. Amid Israel's ongoing military operation in Gaza, human rights groups have documented an alarming increase in settler violence and forced displacement in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. So the last few weeks have been extremely difficult, said Halima Khalil Abu Eid, the mother of two little girls living in Khirbet Susia, a village in the south Hebron Hills in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. A month ago, while the family was asleep, Israeli settlers raided her family's home, beat her husband, and threatened them with an ultimatum. Quote, you have to leave the place. If you don't leave, we will shoot, and you must destroy your home, said Abu Eid, relating the warning she received that night. Well, since the Israel-Hamas war started, Abu Eid said, settlers have intensified their pressure on the residents of Khirbet Susia. Quote, they are ransacking, destroying, and terrorizing us. And the last time they also attacked my husband and his brother-in-law. One of her daughters was vomiting out of fear, she said. Khirbet Susia has seen years of harassment by settlers living in nearby Israeli settlements and settlement farms. But since October 7, the occupied West Bank has witnessed a significant, quote-unquote, increase in settler violence and displacement of Palestinians, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. So on October 7, an attack by Hamas, considered a terrorist organization by the European Union and the United States, killed at least 1,200 people living in southern Israeli communities close to the Gaza Strip, and saw at least 239 taken captive, currently being held hostage in Gaza. The attack has sparked ongoing retaliatory strikes from Israel and a ground offensive in Gaza. And according to the Hamas-led health ministry, Israeli bombardment of the closed-off territory has since killed more than 11,000 Palestinians in Gaza. Rockets are still being fired towards Israel. Well, the Israeli-Hamas war is also having an impact on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. According to OCHA, 168 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank, and an additional 8 have been killed by Israeli settlers, and 3 Israelis have been killed in attacks by Palestinians. According to the United Nations, about 1,149 people from 15 Bedouin and farming communities have been displaced, forced to pack up or demolish their own homes and livestock pens, and some couldn't even take their belongings with them, just like in Khirbet Susia. Rights groups have documented several incidents in which armed settlers have entered Palestinian villages and threatened the residents if they do not leave. Well, Khirbet Susia is a small community of Palestinian families scattered across the hilly landscape. Most farmers and make their living from agriculture and their flocks of sheep. Abu Eid's simple one-story house, tent, and a sheep pen appeared almost peaceful on the day I was visited with a ginger-colored cat snoozing on the midday sun while chickens roamed freely. But the threat of settler violence hangs like a dark cloud over everything and affects their livelihoods. Where should we go? What do they want from us? They just want to take our houses. We know this from the past. Where else can we go? This is our house. This is our home. We can't leave it, said Abouaid. So Kilbet or Kilbet Susia residents must now climb over walls and mounds made of earth, which block entrances into and passage within the village. So that's what's happening to a great extent. Over 240 settler attacks against Palestinians have been recorded since October 7, according to OCHA, resulting in damage to Palestinian-owned property and casualties. These attacks have resulted in the displacement and clearance of whole communities, mainly in Area C, which makes up about 60% of the occupied West Bank. Area C was created under the Oslo Accords in 1995 and was intended to be gradually transferred to Palestinian jurisdiction, but still remains under full Israeli security and administrative control. Well, U.S. President Biden has condemned the violence in the West Bank, saying it has to stop. Quote-unquote, they have to be held accountable. It has to stop now, he said. On a recent trip to the region, German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock visited the West Bank and warned that it, quote, must not be dragged into this whirlpool of violence, end quote. So a lot of concern, that's for sure. That's what's going on. Now, this is very interesting. China's President Xi Jinping and the U.S. President Joe Biden are set to have a high-stakes meeting in California this week. Decoding China, Xi and Biden have to find common ground. The person who photographs Chinese President Xi Jinping with his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden when they meet on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperative APEC summit is set to take place between November 11 and 17 in the U.S. city of San Francisco and will be faced with a task of responsibility. The photo will illustrate the relationship between the two nations, which are rivals in terms of economics and security policy. Stakes are high. If they do not cooperate, global challenges such as climate change cannot be met. The media and the public will be paying attention to facial expressions, posture, and the whole setting to interpret the relationship between the two. At least physically, however, they will be meeting eye to eye. Biden is about 6 feet tall. Xi is probably about just slightly less, but it is not exactly certain, as China treats information like this as it would a state secret. The latest meeting between the two leaders took place back in November 2022 at the G20 summit on the Indonesian island of Bali. And since then, there have been lively political consultations, but Xi and Biden have not directly exchanged views face-to-face. Helena Legarda, a lead analyst from the Mercator Institute for China Studies, MERICS, said that Xi and Biden will be discussing current issues. That is relatively clear. However, it is uncertain whether they will reach a consensus. There may not be much outcome out of the summit. Well, China and the United States are two rival political systems. The relationship between China and the U.S. pits two very different political systems against one another. China is an authoritarian one-party state that has become the second largest economy in the world. Beijing has said it wants to be the strongest country in the world by 2050, a communist country that for decades fought unsuccessfully, albeit hard, against the Western alliance during the Cold War, hopes to have replaced the United States as a global superpower by then. The United States, the world's largest economy and a democracy, wants to defend its place. The two countries are engaged in fierce competition on many levels. The economy is one issue, especially the high-tech sector regarding semiconductors, digitalization, and artificial intelligence. But geopolitical interests also play a role. China wanting to forge alliances with non-Western countries and reshape the U.S.-dominated world order. Ultimately, the question is whether a communist autocracy or a capitalist democracy will become the ideological model of the 21st century. In 1972, the United States, under President Richard Nixon, established diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. These have undergone rapid development over the past few decades, particularly since the introduction of reform and opening up policies under Deng Xiaoping in 1978. China has been able to create close interdependent relationships with other states thanks to its major economic muscle. Its huge market has attracted numerous investors from Europe and the United States who have brought capital and technical know-how. For example, in 2022, German car manufacturer Volkswagen, BMW, and Mercedes generated an average 35% of their respective revenues in China. At the same time, China has invested in Africa, Central Asia, Latin America, and most recently, the Arab world. Its Belt and Road Initiative, also known as the New Silk Road, which has two trade routes, one land and one maritime, is one prominent project. China also plays a leading role in the BRICS Plus group of major emerging economies, originally comprised of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. The group is being expanded to include six more members, as some 40 countries have expressed an interest in joining. China is practicing a form of statecraft that uses economic leverage to try to achieve political goals in relation to other states, end quote, said Markus Taube, a professor at the University of Duisburg-Essen in Germany and economic expert on China. At a German-Chinese business conference in Düsseldorf last week, Taube said, quote, China wants more influence in the global system and is also demanding it. As a result, there is more antagonism with the Western world. We are experiencing the renaissance of economic statecraft, quote unquote, as an instrument for pursuing higher national goals. To the United States think tank, the Atlantic Council, quote, economic statecraft is the use of financial, regulatory, and economic tools to achieve foreign policy objectives, end quote. Ironically, it was initially the West that wanted to generate change through economic statecraft, quote unquote, particularly in the 1990s. The German catchphrase was Wandel durch Handel, change through trade. And German theorists of order thought the complex economies could not function without liberal social models. And that change through the trade, would set in motion a process of harmonization. We can see today that this is not entirely correct, explained Taube. China has proven that capitalism and autocracy are an excellent match. The big challenge for Western countries and the ultimately long-term concern would be that China has expressed its ambition to reform the current global order, rules, values, and principles so that they are more in line with their own, said Legada from Merricks. The U.S.-led group of seven, the G7, a liberal democratic group of seven industrialized nations, and of which Germany is a member, has offered to work with China on, quote, global challenges as well as areas of common interest. A G7 minister statement released after their meeting in Japan on November 8 asserts, quote, we stand prepared to build constructive and stable relations with China, recognizing the importance of engaging candidly and expressing our concerns directly. Ahead of Xi's visit to the United States, there have been calls for President Biden to respond more decisively to Chinese provocations in the China Sea and elsewhere. But for China and the United States to overcome common challenges, a pragmatic alliance is necessary, despite systemic rivalry. The West is also struggling to find like-minded companions in this epic competition. Quote, as democracies, we can only hold our own in a systemic competition with autocratic forces if our friends around the globe sense that we are serious, end quote, said the federal foreign minister, Annalena Baerbock, prior to her departure for Tokyo. So these are some of the issues that are very, very pertinent, to say the least. This is very interesting with regard to Iran. Fears for the jailed Peace Prize winner, Nahis Mohammadi. Iranian officials have apparently allowed Nahis Mohammadi, the 2023 Nobel Peace Prize winner, to see a doctor despite her refusal to wear a headscarf. Her husband still fears for her life. Nahis Mohammadi, one of the best-known human rights activists in Iran, is incarcerated in Tehran's notorious Evin prison. Earlier this year, she was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for her ongoing fight against the oppression of women in Iran, as well as for her advocacy for human rights and freedom for all. On November 6, she went on a hunger strike. For health reasons, because the prison authorities refused to take her to hospital without a headscarf. Her husband, Tahi Ahmani, advised Deutsche Welle that Nahis refused to wear the mandatory headscarf. Seven other political prisoners in the women's section of Evin prison joined the hunger strike in solidarity. On Thursday, the 51-year-old human rights activist informed her family, quote, "I was admitted to hospital after all on Wednesday under strict security measures without a headscarf. I have therefore ended my hunger strike," end quote. Following a brief examination, she was taken back to prison. The official statement from the prison authorities said that Mohammadi was examined in hospital on Wednesday and no lung problems were detected. The results of further examinations are still pending, it said. Quote, "She has heart disease," end quote, her husband explained. 3 years ago, she had a major heart operation. Back then, she collapsed and was taken from prison to the operating room. Two of her coronary arteries are narrowed. It's noted in her medical records, he added. Nahis requires ongoing medical care, end quote. Rahmani, a writer and political journalist, lives in exile in Paris. He doesn't trust the Iranian officials. He also spent 14 years in prison in Iran before leaving the country in 2012, and back then his wife didn't want to go into exile with him. Mohammadi wants to continue her fight in Iran against arbitrary prosecution, for freedom of expression, and for an independent judiciary. Mohammadi has repeatedly been arrested and sentenced to jail, terms for her peaceful advocacy for human rights. However, she could not be silenced. She began to document the suffering of her fellow prisoners in her book, White Torture, quote unquote. The expression refers to a method of psychological torture in which prisoners are isolated in a totally white cell for an extended, indefinite period. Since November 2021, Mohammadi has been back in prison, and during the nationwide protests that followed the death of Jinnah Mahsa Amini, she wrote a letter that was smuggled out of prison and published on social media. In it, she described the sexual and physical abuse of incarcerated women. Quote, "As a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Nahis is a figure who is known all over the world. I believe that's why they allowed her a brief hospital visit and a medical examination," end quote, said the 28-year-old photographer and activist Ghazal Abdullahi. She is the daughter of Aliyeh Motalebzadeh, a photojournalist and women's rights activist who was until recently imprisoned alongside Mohammadi. Ghazal left Iran last year when the protests were in full swing. She took part in a demonstration at which her friends were arrested. She was able to escape the authorities and initially hid at the house of some acquaintances. As she already had a visa for Germany, she decided to leave the country. In Germany, she strives to give women and political prisoners a voice. Quote, "We know that sick political prisoners are deliberately neglected," end quote, she said. Continuing, she says, "They are given their medication late. or are not taken to hospital. In Nahez's case, the authorities are more careful now because they don't want to attract global public attention, end quote. Iran is not the focus of global public attention right now. The authorities are exploiting this in order to continue intimidating the population and, for example, to carry out many death sentences, end quote. According to United Nations report, Iran executed at least 419 people in the first 7 months of this year, 30% more than in the same period in 2022. At the beginning of November, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres accused Iran of Tehran of disregarding principles of the rule of law, and the United Nations described it as alarming. Yep, that's the crisis, that's for sure. One second. Bear with me a moment as we cover some other issues. One second. Well, the United Nations has warned that Gaza aid work will ground to a halt in 48 hours without fuel. One second. Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital is not functioning as a hospital anymore, says the World Health Organization. On Sunday night, they managed to restore communication with health professionals at Gaza City's Al-Shifa hospital a day after losing contact with the largest hospital in the besieged enclave. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, however, said that the hospital was not functional after 3 days without electricity amid heavy fighting. Al-Quds, Gaza's second largest hospital, has also suspended operations, according to staff. And so that is the problem. So one second here. And this is interesting. In Great Britain, the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak appointed former Prime Minister David Cameron to take over the United Kingdom's foreign policy dossier during the cabinet reshuffle today. Sunak's first government shakeup since entering office in October of 2022. He also sacked controversial Interior Minister Suella Braverman, replacing her with Foreign Minister James Cleverly. Bear with me a moment. So British former Premier David Cameron was named the country's new Foreign Secretary on Monday in a surprise appointment by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak as he reshuffled his top team. It was the latest reset for a Prime Minister whose party has trailed the main Labour opposition by double-digit margins throughout his time in power and is widely tipped to lose the next election slated for sometime next year. Cameron's return to government suggests Sunak wants to bring in more centrist, experienced hands rather than appease the right flank of his party that supported Braverman. His unexpected return to British politics comes after he spent the last 7 years writing his memoirs and pursue business interests, including in Greensill Capital, a finance firm that later collapsed. Cameron will be made a life peer in the House of Lords, Britain's unelected upper chamber of parliament, making him eligible to sit in government. In a statement released shortly after his new role was announced, Cameron said that Britain was, quote, facing a daunting set of international challenges, including the war in Ukraine and the crisis in the Middle East, end quote. Continuing, he said, while I have been out of frontline politics for the last 7 years, I hope that my experience as Conservative leader for 11 years and Prime Minister for 6 will assist me in helping the Prime Minister to meet these vital challenges, he said. It is rare for a non-lawmaker to take a senior government post, and it has been decades since a former Prime Minister held a cabinet job. The move also marks the return to government of a leader brought down by Britain's decision to leave the European Union. Cameron called the 2016 Brexit referendum confident the country would vote to stay in the bloc. He resigned the day after voters opted to leave. Cameron's foreign policy legacy is mixed. As Prime Minister, he backed the NATO-led military intervention in Libya in 2011 that toppled Muammar Gaddafi, but deepened the country's chaos. And in 2013, he tried and failed to gain parliamentary backing for United Kingdom airstrikes against President Bashar al-Assad's forces in Syria. He also announced a short-lived golden era in UK-China relations shortly before the relationship soured. So Braverman's out. And Sunak had come under growing pressure to axe the Interior Minister Braverman, an outspoken right-winger, after critics accused her of heightening tensions during weeks of contentious pro-Palestinian demonstrations and counter-protests in Britain. Following her dismissal, Braverman said, "It has been the greatest privilege of my life to serve as Home Secretary," end quote. "I will have more to say in due course," she added. Braverman was replaced by erstwhile Foreign Minister James Cleverly. Braverman had stoked controversy throughout her tenure, taking a hardline stance on immigration in particular and regularly wading into so-called culture wars issues, which are seen as dividing the electorate. The right-winger attacked her critics as liberal, quote, tofu-eating Wokerati, while saying shortly after she was appointed that sending asylum seekers to Rwanda was her, quote, dream, end quote, and obsession, quote, end quote. But her position became increasingly untenable after she last week wrote an explosive newspaper article, without Sunak's approval, accusing police of bias towards left-wing causes. It was blamed for stoking tensions ahead of a weekend of protests over Israel's war in Gaza, which coincided with Armistice Day events and prompted calls for her to be sacked. Well, the firing comes as the ruling Conservatives confirmed a major reshuffle of Sunak's top ministers was underway, his first since becoming the country's leader in October 25 of 2022. "Here we go," the party said on X, formerly Twitter. Quote, "Today, Rishi Sunak strengthens his team in government to deliver long-term decisions for a brighter future. Stay tuned for the latest." So Sunak made additional changes to the government throughout the day, naming Victoria Atkins as the new health secretary and moving her predecessor, Steve Barclay, to the environmental portfolio. So we'll just have to see where all this goes, but definitely a change, and hopefully for the better for Great Britain. And this is interesting, the latest information from Zelensky. Zelensky says that Ukraine must be prepared for a Russian winter onslaught. President Volodymyr Zelensky warned Ukrainians on Sunday to prepare for new waves of Russian attacks on infrastructure as winter approached, and said troops were anticipating an onslaught in the eastern theater of the war. A military spokesman said that Russian attacks on the shattered eastern town of Avdiivka had eased in the past day, but were likely to intensify in the coming days. And Ukrainian military intelligence said an explosion killed at least three Russian servicemen in the Russian-occupied southern town of Melitopol, which it described as an act of revenge, quote-unquote, by resistance groups. Zelensky issued his warning during his nightly video address a day after Russian forces carried out their first missile attack on the capital, Kyiv, in some 7 weeks. "We are almost halfway through November and must be prepared for the fact that the enemy may increase the number of drone or missile strikes on our infrastructure," Zelensky said. "Russia is preparing for Ukraine, and here in Ukraine, all attention should be focused on defense, on responding to terrorists, on everything that Ukraine can do to get through the winter and improve our soldiers' capabilities. Last winter, about 10 months into Russia's invasion of neighbor Ukraine, Russia made waves of attacks on power stations and other plants linked to the energy network, prompting rolling blackouts in widely separated regions. Energy Minister Helman Galushchenko said on Saturday that Ukraine would have enough energy resources to get through the winter, but added, quote, the question is how much future attacks can affect supplies, end quote. Ukrainian officials last Wednesday said that Russia had struck Ukrainian infrastructure 60 times in recent weeks, an indication that a campaign of attacks may already be underway. In his remarks, Zelensky hailed the heroic efforts of troops defending Avdiivka under pressure from attempted Russian advances since mid-October. And pictures show buildings in the town reduced to shells. Military spokesman Oleksandr Stupin said that the number of infantry attacks in the past 24 hours was half of levels earlier in the week, but airstrikes were on the rise. Quote, the enemy suffered significant losses the day before yesterday and has to regroup, and quote, Stupin told national television. The head of Ukraine's ground forces, General Oleksandr Stilsky, said on Telegram that Moscow's forces were, quote, more active in the Bakhmut sector and trying to recover lost positions, end quote. Bakhmut, north of the city of Donetsk, was captured by Russian forces in May after months of heavy combat, but Ukrainian forces have since retaken nearby villages. Russian accounts of the fighting on Sunday said its forces had repelled five Ukrainian attacks near Bakhmut. Reuters could not verify accounts from either side. In Melitopol, a hub for Russian occupation forces, the blast killed three men during a meeting at a post office used as a military headquarters, Ukraine's military intelligence directorate had said, and the dead were officers of Russia's National Guard or FSB intelligence service, the directorate said in a statement. There was no comment from Russian officials. Ukraine's military has been increasingly active in attacking Russian held areas, but does not always acknowledge the strikes. So this is a report from Reuters. one second. One second here. Okay. One moment here. One more second. All right, for some reason I can't reach this information. So not much I can do here. So bear with me a moment. One moment. One second here. All right, I just want to check one other thing. This is about 14, 15 hours ago. The U.S. has hit Iran-linked sites in Syria. It seems that U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin in a statement said that the airstrikes were ordered by President Joe Biden in response to repeated attacks against U.S. troops. The United States conducted two airstrikes targeting two Iran-linked sites in eastern Syria in response to a series of attacks against American troops in Syria and in Iraq, the Pentagon said on Sunday. While the airstrikes by the U.S. killed at least eight pro-Iran fighters in eastern Syria, according to a war monitor, the toll is eight pro-Iran fighters dead, including at least one Syrian and Iraqi nationals, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said on Monday, that's today, and U.S. military forces conducted precision strikes today on facilities in eastern Syria used by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, and Iran-affiliated groups in response to continued attacks against U.S. personnel in Iraq and Syria, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said in a statement. The two strikes on Sunday targeted a training facility in Abu Hamal and a safe house in Mayadin. This is the third time in a span of 3 weeks that the U.S. has launched attacks against Syrian locations that it alleges are linked to Iran. Austin said that the strikes were ordered by President Joe Biden. Quote, the president has no higher priority than the safety of U.S. personnel, and he directed today's actions to make clear that the United States will defend itself, its personnel, and its interests, Austin said in a statement. Austin also hinted at the possibility of conducting more strikes in Syria. These attacks must stop, and if they don't stop, then we won't hesitate to do what's necessary again to protect the troops, Austin told reporters at a news conference in Seoul, Korea. Well, there's a surge in military strikes against Israel-Hamas conflict. Before Sunday's attacks, the U.S. has said it targeted an Iran-linked weapons storage site in Syria on Wednesday. And then on October 26th, it had hit two locations in the country that it alleged were used by Iran and affiliated organizations. According to the United States, Iran-backed groups have repeatedly targeted American forces, injuring dozens of personnel. Pro-Iranian militias have intensified their attacks against U.S. forces in the countries amid the Israel-Hamas conflict that escalated after the October 7 attacks. There are about 2,500 American soldiers deployed in Iraq, and some 900 are in Syria in a bid to help prevent a resurgence of the Islamic State group. So that's what's really happening there. One second, I want you to check something else. Bear with me a moment here. This is very interesting with regard to tax havens. Corporations are winning big, so the question is, who loses in the process? Well, a report by the European Union Tax Observatory, an independent research lab hosted at Gulag Economics, shows that multinational corporations avoid paying $200 billion in taxes worldwide in 2020, the last year for which data is available. All this money was evaded through profit shifting, a strategy used by companies that have subsidiaries in many different countries. They register a disproportionate amount of their profits in territories with low or no taxation, known as tax havens. And this happens even though the profits were made in other countries. But how does profit shifting work? Why does it matter? And who are the winners and losers? How does profit shifting work? Picture a multinational company that works in two different countries. Most of the work is done in a country with high taxation. However, intellectual property such as patents and design blueprints are held by a subsidiary in a territory with lower taxes. The company in the first country where the profits are made must pay the subsidiary to use the registered properties. And as the multinational controls both entities, it can set up the price of the transaction. In the end, it makes the company in the high taxation territory pay lots of money to the subsidiary in the tax haven. So after the deal, the profit ledger in the first company falls, while the balance in the tax haven subsidiary increases. The multinational can now declare less profits in the place where taxes would be higher and more in the places where they are lower. This is not merely an exercise of imagination. It happened recently with U.S. footwear giant Nike. A document showed that while production and sales of sneakers happened in high-tax countries, the local units of the company had to pay royalties to a subsidiary in Bermuda where taxes are virtually non-existent, and similar schemes were reported for multinationals such as Microsoft and Apple. So why does it matter? The global tax revenue lost to profit shifting was around $200 billion in 2020, a year when the COVID-19 pandemic massively hurt economic activity in 2019, that figure was $250 billion. To put the revenue loss in 2020 in context, it's around a fifth of the investments that developing countries to mitigate the effects of climate change, according to estimates made by an expert group of economists that met in the COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. Idan Gidron, the data coordinator at the European Union Tax Observatory, said only large companies can afford to trade in international markets and open subsidiaries in offshore tax havens. This way, the biggest players end up with a smaller tax burden. And this creates fiscal injustice because the smaller actors in the economy have to contribute more than the wealthiest, he said. So that's the story. So, of course, the biggest winners of profit shifting are the companies that that save on taxes. A disproportionate amount of them come from the United States. Around 40% of all profits shifted globally originate from U.S. multinationals. So while conglomerates save billions by shifting profits into tax havens that also benefit. Gidron says for their research that countries with effective tax rates below 15% are considered tax havens. It considers the rates that are normally applied and not what is written on paper, as legal loopholes are often used to reduce taxation levels. The report also takes into account countries where multinationals make profits that are excessively high in comparison to the total wages they pay locally, an indicator that the profits booked are being transferred from places where the real work gets done. And some tiny countries do not apply taxes at all, but still benefit from an increased level of economic activity on the ground. Even if the local units are very small operations for the multinationals, they can still be significant for smaller economies. Larger tax havens, on the other hand, can apply their lower taxation rates on the shifted profits. Even if the taxes are comparatively low, they line their pockets with revenues they wouldn't otherwise have access to. So where are the tax havens? Countries in the Caribbean, but the tax havens that are attracting most of the profits are actually in Europe. Countries like the Netherlands, Ireland, Switzerland, Luxembourg, and Belgium receive more profits than tropical paradises like Panama or Bermuda. This results on budget surpluses in those countries. In Ireland, for example, shifted profits generate around 60% of all the corporate tax the country collected in 2020. Well, it looks like we've run out of time, so we're going to need to say goodbye. And I want to thank you for being with us, that's for sure. So have a good day, and thank you again. Let me just see what we can do here. We're going to end the episode. Be well, and thank you. Goodbye.